This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Go into any bookshop and you'll find countless titles written about him. Open up Netflix and there'll be more documentaries about him than practically any other subject. Go on social media and you'll usually only be a few clicks away from reading his name. Why is it that so much conversation still gravitates towards Adolf Hitler? And what sustains the ongoing fascination with one of the worst people to have ever lived? I'm Jacob Jarvis, and here to discuss this with me is Sir Richard J. Evans, Regius Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Cambridge, and the author of The Hitler Conspiracies, The Third Reich and the Paranoid Imagination, as well as countless other titles such as The Third Reich in History and Memory, Altered Pasts and Telling Lies About Hitler. Richard, thank you very much for joining me for The Bunker.
No, thanks for the invitation.
Before we broaden out to the wider societal focus on Hitler and the fascination around him, you've been writing about Hitler for decades. When did your interest in him as a topic begin, and how do you continue to find new avenues to explore when you are writing about Hitler?
Well, I'm a baby boomer, so I was born just after the war, and we lived on the fringes of London's East End. So we used to go in shopping to Stratford, Leighton, Hackney, and so on. And what really struck me in the early to mid-50s was the number of bomb sites there, rows of terraced houses with one suddenly missing. And I remember the shocking effect of the exposed upper floors with their bedroom wallpaper and so on. It was really strange. And I wondered, who'd done this? Why did they do it? And so on. And that's what really, I think, began my interest. Later on, of course, as I went to school and then university, this was a time then in the 60s when German history, modern German history, and particularly the Nazis, was just opening up. German historians are beginning to investigate the Nazis, the reasons for the Nazis, what they did, the nature of German society, why people joined them, and why did particular, why do people support Hitler? And the first arguments about Hitler were beginning between those like Alan Bullock, who wrote the first big biography, who thought that he was just a power-mad opportunist, and like Hugh Trevor Roper, who thought he was an ideologue and had some principles. I mean, absurd principle, but principles nonetheless, which he followed through his life. So that really got me hooked and got me interested. And then once you get into a subject, of course, it then drags you in further. And how can you find out new things about Hitler, including new material for a book that I'm coming out with Penguin this August? Forgive the plug, it's called Hitler's People. Well, one big reason is that our perspectives change. We look upon the past differently now because of the experiences we had. You can now look at Hitler through the eyes, as it were, or the experience or the words of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not Hitler, he's nothing like him, but his relationship to the truth and to politics and things like that, and his hostility to democracy, all of that, I think, make us look at Hitler afresh. And then perhaps just as important, if not more so, is the material. Unbelievably, there's new material, new documents coming out about Hitler, not to mention the other Nazis, all the time. So his propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, kept a diary, voluminous diary, 32 volumes, and the last volume came out in 2008. And there are many, many other documents that we can look at, and that causes us to regard Hitler with a fresh eye.
When it comes to historians writing about Hitler and researching Hitler, you know, I can't imagine him ever not being someone that would be taken in an incredibly serious way. But was there a point in history when perhaps historical research around him wasn't quite so robust? And when did the turning point come for people to really start investigating him in the way you discussed, sort of around the time of the 1950s and so on?
Yeah, well, of course, people found it difficult to take him entirely seriously, particularly the British, I think. There was a notorious incident when the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, going to a meeting with Hitler, handed him his umbrella and his top hat because he thought he was a waiter. Some Germans didn't take him seriously because he had this southern Bavarian accent, or rather thick accent, and northern Germans didn't like that very much. Cartoonists, of course, like Donald Lowe, famously drew a lot of cartoons ridiculing Hitler, but he was, by some people, of course, taken seriously at the beginning. The first biography appeared during Hitler's lifetime by Conrad Haydn. It's very important to realize that Hitler was really not important until 1929 or 1930, during the Weimar Republic, the democratic system set up in Germany at the end of the First World War. Hitler emerged as leader at this party, but it got less than 3% of the national vote in 1928 in Germany. So nobody paid him a huge amount of attention. And then just a few years later, in 1932, it had become the biggest political party, and people began to sit up and look and examine Hitler, ask who he was.
Was there a particular point we can pinpoint where the depictions of him did go from a figure of fun to this, what we see now, and for me, one of the reasons it would appear there's still this fascination with him, is just a depiction of an almost absolute evil?
I think so, yes. I mean, that's a very good question. If you look at the way the British regarded Hitler right up until the last years of the 20th century, he was seen mainly in terms of someone who tried to conquer the whole of Europe. And that way he was seen as seriously as a threat. He was depicted as a warmonger. But it's only in the 1990s, with the emergence of the Holocaust, what the Nazis called the final solution of the Jewish question in Europe, a question, of course, which they invented themselves, the extermination of 6 million Jews, that is when he came to be seen as the incarnation of evil. There are a number of stages of that. I think the world began to wake up to Hitler as the man who developed and then forced the carrying out of the mass murder of 6 million Jews in Europe. With the Eichmann trial, the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who is one of the main planners and architects of the Holocaust in 1961, the Frankfurt Auschwitz trials, where a number of SS guards and warders in the extermination camp at Auschwitz were tried in Germany. Those, I think, were a big turning point. And then later on, you look at the fall of communism in 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall. That is when I think attention began to take away from Stalinism, from communism, which themselves are responsible for millions of deaths, and focus more exclusively on Hitler. So 1990s, when you see Holocaust memorial museums being built, not only in Washington, D.C., but all over the world, including the Holocaust memorial wing of the Imperial War Museum in London.
There have been many murderous dictators throughout history. Why is it that you think Hitler remains that consistent standpoint for evil, you know, in terms of our social morality?
What is unique about what we now call the Holocaust? It's a genocide, and unfortunately there have been other genocides, of course, both before and since the Holocaust. But it was different, and it was different from other genocides because Hitler and the Nazis had a conspiracy theory of extraordinary dimensions and intensity. They believed that Jews all over the world, by virtue of their inheritance, by their very nature, were hell-bent on destroying Germany, on subverting civilization. Goebbels, the propaganda minister under Hitler, described the Jew, as he always called it in the singular, as if there was only one kind of Jew, as the world enemy. That meant all Jews had to be killed and exterminated wherever they were. Himmler, the main architect, man of the Holocaust, the man in charge of the SS who carried it out in the first place, gave a notorious speech in Posen during the war where he said that Jewish children and women have to be killed because if they're allowed to survive, they will carry on their desperate, dastardly work of destroying civilization. And that is why all Jews everywhere had to be exterminated in Hitler's mind. You find in the Wannsee Protocol, the Wannsee is a lake on the west of Berlin, and a conference was held at the beginning of 1942 of major Nazi civil servants and officials to coordinate the extermination program. And they produced minutes which list every country's number of Jews, Jewish population, the ones slated by the Nazis for killing. And quite a lot of these were not under Nazi control at all. I mean, it's like Ireland, for example. It's bizarre. So that was an existential threat. Himmler even went to Finland, where there are hardly any Jews at all, to persuade the government, not very successfully, I have to say, to surrender its tiny, tiny Jewish population for killing. Other populations subject to mass murder and genocide have been killed, not because they're a global threat, because it's simply got in the way of something else, the building of a nation, for example, the settlement of an area. They were not seen as a global threat. And that means when you look at reports and descriptions, the horrible way in which the Jews are killed, there's always an element of sadism, the desire on the part of the Nazis to humiliate the Jews that you don't find in dealing with other kinds of genocides.
You wrote in The Guardian previously that the Third Reich represents racism's most extreme form, and that in Nazi Germany, everything came down to race. Is unfortunately the reality that this racism in certain sections of society across the world still persists? So that's another reason why referencing Hitler and the Nazis continues to persist, because unfortunately there are still people who hold beliefs which align with those incredibly extreme beliefs. So whilst many of us will have seen it as extreme evil, some people see it as some variety of example or a template of their ideological systems.
Yeah, Nazism's racism, its exterminatory racism, is the most extreme example of racism that you will find anywhere in history or anywhere in the world. And so we look to that as a kind of example of how far racism can go if you don't stop it at an earlier stage.
Godwin's Law. So that's the theory that the longer a conversation rolls on the internet, the more likely it is that someone is to be compared to Hitler or the Nazis. What are your thoughts on this happening? And do you think that people have become too quick to reference this era as an example of, you know, someone saying something that they disagree with or don't like?
Well, concepts have a way of kind of expanding beyond their original meaning. It's a very common phenomenon. You look at a prison camp and you say, oh, it's Auschwitz, or even some people say it's worse than Auschwitz. Mm. You look at a dictator, some people will say it's too tempting to condemn a dictator by saying, oh, just like Hitler, you know. Yeah. So I think we have to be very careful about this kind of expansion and loss of meaning of concepts, names, ideas, and so on. Someone like Donald Trump, for example, would be a dictator or at least authoritarian leader, an enemy of democracy. It's too tempting to say, try to discredit him more by saying he's like Hitler. But he's not like Hitler, of course, because Hitler wanted to conquer the world. Hitler was a militarist. It was completely unlike Trump, because Trump is an isolationist. He does not want to conquer the world. He's not a militarist. He doesn't dress up his followers in military uniform like Hitler did. Mm. So, but if we want to condemn him, we'll say, it's just like Hitler. So I think we have to have some conceptual distinctions here.
Mm. You've researched people's sort of discussions around Hitler, and it strikes me that a lot of work around studying Hitler seems to have switched to almost having to look at the way that bad historians are conducting history, let's call it, around Hitler, and then good historians like yourself having to look at that and say, I'm not quite sure that is right. But have you seen the obsession deepen throughout the social media age? Because you were researching this before the social media age and have continued to since. Or is there also quite a straight line through, you know, the yellow press through to now? Has it accelerated, or is it just sort of ramps up in a quite steady line from then?
Yeah, I mean, we live in a secular age by and large. I mean, some countries like Britain are more secular than others like America. But as we've ceased to believe in Satan as the devil, as a concrete individual person, we found in Hitler, I think, something of a substitute for that, a sort of icon of evil. You might think that obsession with the Nazis and with Hitler has declined as those who lived through World War II and survived the Holocaust in particular have passed away. But that's not the case. In fact, it's become greater the fewer people are around to say, I was there and it wasn't like that. That's now become the job of the historian. But I think in particular, the rise of the internet and above all social media has contributed to this kind of cheapening of trivialization in some ways of Hitler, and this cheapening of the meaning and the expansion of the meaning of Hitler, Auschwitz, and so on. The internet and the social media in particular, because they're unregulated and largely uncontrolled, allow that. You can say anything you like up to a point, but you can say anything you like, whereas you couldn't say that when there were gatekeepers of opinion and expression around, like magazine editors, newspaper editors, radio and TV program controllers, and so on. It's now become much, much easier.
Is it all about context somewhat as well? Because I know, you know, there were plenty of magazines in the past which wrote about Hitler still being alive and stuff like that, but they were the kind of magazines which people knew to not take seriously. Whereas now, if people get that sort of conspiracy theory through their phone screen, it can come alongside serious information as well as flippant information, and it then is harder to work out which is separate, and that makes some people take it more seriously than they might have in the past if they knew they were buying a sort of provocative magazine which deliberately pushed those sort of stories.
Yeah, if you go to the street stalls in New York and you see the National Enquirer and you buy it, you know it's not serious. You know, it's about aliens abducted my son, that kind of thing. But it's difficult to tell on social media. I have to make a plug for education here. I think that university education in particular should make you think, make you give you a critical acumen whereby you can tell plausible, defensible opinions from those that are neither plausible nor defensible. It's a good thing that we're now educating nearly half of our British young population in universities, and I hope that that will have an effect. But basically, it's to do with education. It's discriminating between rubbish with no proper evidence and opinions and arguments that do have some support in the evidence. And it's very worrying. Some people have said we live in what they call a post-truth society, that where we no longer really believe that there's such a thing as the truth. And I've written about trying to defend the notion that there is such a thing as the truth. I wrote a book called In Defense of History a long time ago now, in the mid-1990s, where I put forward the argument that you can find out about the past, you can find out real things that happened, you can establish the truth about major and not so major historical events at a time when some academics in particular were saying, no, you can't really find it. It's all opinion, you know. In which case I would say to them, well, what you're saying is just opinion. It's got no evidence for it. Why should I believe it?
Do you think this gravitation to be interested in someone like Hitler is just simply human nature, that we're going to be obsessed with something which has been so grim and so terrible? Or do you feel it's been manufactured somewhat? Because, as I say, every time I open Netflix, there seems to be a new Hitler documentary of some kind, and a lot of them don't seem to be massively new. It's the same sort of stuff repackaged in slightly different ways. It clearly, to some extent, makes money for, as unfortunately, like entertainment for people. Do you think there has been a manufacturing of that by some people who are maybe not coming at it from such an objective angle of wanting to discover truth?
Yeah, at the far edge of this, there is what's been called the pornography of violence. And there's also a way in which a number of things connected with Hitler and the Nazis have become kind of iconic in the sense that they've left their direct connection with historical reality and taken on a kind of life of their own. There's a film, which actually I've perversely rather enjoyed, but it's been described as one of the worst films ever made, called Iron Sky, which is a kind of series of fantasies about Nazis fleeing to the far side of the moon and setting up a kind of new Third Reich there and coming back to invade the world and so on. It doesn't add anything to our understanding of Hitler and the Nazis, and there's a sense in which they have become a kind of part of the entertainment industry. We know instantly who we're dealing with, and all you need to do is have a kind of picture with a face, a little toothbrush moustache, a slick of hair, black hair across the forehead, and you know who that is. I think, on the other hand, there is obviously a real human, as you suggested, a real kind of human need behind this. We all feel that we have dark impulses inside us, as well as humane and positive ones. We want constantly to be reminded of what the difference between good and evil is. It is not a simple question at all. And so seeing what the worst that humanity can do, that is a kind of way in which we can use as a sort of signpost to the much lesser, often more trivial decisions that we have to make between doing something good and doing something bad.
Finally, when it comes to new bits of information which are emerging around Hitler and the Nazis, what are some of the things which you have found most interesting lately, and what are you looking into?
Well, I think with Hitler, we now have all of his speeches are all on record in huge multi-volume collections. His writings are available. We can go through that material and figure out, in a way, what his ambitions were and what he wanted. And I was quite startled to find, for example, in the records of his speeches, not all of which were public, some of them were just to Nazis, groups of Nazis and gatherings of Nazis, how unlimited his ambition was. I mean, I found one in 1930, which has not been treated very much, where he says quite explicitly to his Nazi followers that our ambition is to conquer the entire world. You know, we are going to become the leading country in the world. The word he uses in German is Weltherrschaft, which means rule over the world. And he tried to keep that kind of quiet in the rest of the 1930s when he was dealing with other countries. But that's, I thought, very startling and illuminating. We also have now more records of his private life. So there used to be claimed by historians that he didn't have a private life, and he encouraged that by saying, I'm married to Germany, I've sacrificed my own private life. That was not true at all. We've got the records of his doctor, for example, and we know that he had a kind of private life alongside his public one. With countless numbers of things, what he said, what he believed, his role in the extermination of the Jews, which is very much recorded, all of those kinds of things. So we know a lot more now than we did even 20 years ago.
Richard, thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, remember that you can back us on Patreon. From £3 a month, you'll get every episode of The Bunker ad-free and early. Search Bunker Patreon Podcast or follow the link in the show notes. I'm Jacob Jarvis, and thank you for listening to The Bunker.
The Bunker was written and presented by Jacob Jarvis and produced by Eliza Davis Beard. With audio production from Robin Lieben, video production by Kieran Leslie, music by Kenny Dickinson, and art by Jim Parrott. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.